Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since the 2007-2008 food crisis, several reports have been released focusing on the best ways to feed a growing population by the year 2050. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, 1 billion people go hungry every day, and about 3 billion are not eating well. By 2050, they say food production must increase to 60% to feed the expected 9 billion population. According to a report by ActionAid, misguided policy prescriptions that call for the expansion of industrial-scale agricultural development ignore the true threats to our global food supply, and they are biofuels expansion, inadequate investment in climate-resilient agriculture, lagging support for small-scale and women food producers, and the massive loss of food to spoilage and waste. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by hosting a discussion about what needs to be done to ensure that everyone is fed. How are current agricultural policies contributing to food insecurity? And what measures should be taken to ensure a healthy food supply and a more equitable distribution model? Today, we're joined by Kristen Sundell. She's a policy analyst at ActionAid USA. That's a nonprofit working with poor and marginalized communities to eradicate poverty by overcoming the injustice and inequality that cause it. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Raj Patel, visiting scholar at UC Berkeley Center for African Studies and a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy. Raj is the author of Stuffed and Starved and most recently The Value of Nothing. He's currently working on a documentary about the global hunger issue. And Raj joins me in studio. Hi, Raj. Nice to see you.
Good to be back, Rose.
Great to have you. So, Kristen, you are co-author of a new report, Rising to the Challenge, Changing Course to Feed the World in 2050. And you were also at the World Food Prize. It got a fair amount of attention because they gave awards to employees or high-level executives with Monsanto and Syngenta. And you said that at that conference, the buzz was, in order to feed the population by 2050, we have to at least double food production. Can you talk about that?
Yes, that figure came out from the FAO after the food price crisis of 2008. And although they have, as you mentioned in the introduction, since scaled down its projections of what will be necessary to a 60% increase in food production, the call to double food production obviously captures the imagination in a much more powerful way. And it's still the most commonly cited figure in the press and elsewhere, and this was everywhere at the World Food Prize this year. The call to double food production and then the resulting push for large-scale, high-tech, high-resource solutions to the problem of global hunger.
Well, when you look at the population that's expected to grow by about to 9 billion by 2050, a lot of people would say, well, that seems kind of reasonable to increase food production or double it. But you have a problem with that. Why?
Well, we think that the basic assumptions really need to be carefully examined that are behind these projections or these economic forecasts that are calling for dramatically expanding food production. And we need to really think about hunger as it's there is no global we that feeds the world. The world is not fed in aggregate. Hunger occurs at local and regional levels. And the solutions are going to be found at local and regional levels. And, for example, you know, researchers have found that land redistribution and education for rural women and support for smallholders and investment in smallholder farmers and women farmers at the local level has a far greater impact in addressing the social drivers of hunger than increasing food production globally. And I think Mark Bittman made the point really well in an op-ed recently where he points out that, you know, feeding the world might as well be a marketing slogan for big agriculture, he says, a euphemism for let's ramp up sales, as if producing more cars would guarantee that everyone had one. But if it worked that way, we wouldn't see the rates of hunger in the United States as high as they are. where we have the highest percentage of any developed nation.
And Mark Bittman writes a food column for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Raj, can we step back here and just talk about what we're currently facing? You hear this a lot, that 1 billion people around the globe go hungry, but it's really hard to visualize that.
Well, I mean, it's 1 in 7 people are going hungry. I mean, and if one looks in the United States, as Kristen was saying, you know, there are 50 million people, more or less, who are food insecure. Now, the billion who are going hungry worldwide are undernourished. That's to say that they get less than around 1,700 calories a day. In the United States, that figure is different. But in the United States, we have this measure of hunger that's called food insecurity. And frankly, you can see it everywhere. If you go to your local supermarket, you'll find the sort of operating mode of food insecurity happening, where you have people who are homeless and hungry outside, even though right inside there's more food than anyone can shake a stick at. And that very visible hunger sits alongside far less visible hunger that, for example, in the United States, 1 in 2 children at some point in their lives will be relying on federal nutrition assistance because of an inability at home to be able to afford food. Now, again, and I'm so pleased Kristen brought up that Mark Bittman article, because people often think that if we merely produce more food, it will magically end up in the stomachs of people who need it. And of course, the United States is the prime model of showing how that doesn't work, and also why this conversation around the World Food Prize, around massive food production, is really not the right question. We do need to be thinking much more about distribution and about making sure that the people who are poorest get food. And of course, it's often forgotten in this debate that really when we're talking about hunger, what we really mean is poverty. Mm. And often we're caught up in this world of Thomas Malthus, the world's first economist, right, who said that he thinks about things in aggregate. So we have an aggregate world food supply and an aggregate population. And at some point, there'll be not enough food and too many people, and there'll be all kinds of catastrophe and everything will go horribly wrong. Now, that image sits, and that logic sits in the heads of most of us, doing bad work. And really, we need to be thinking much more about distribution, because at the moment, we have more calories per person than ever before in human history. Mm. We are not running short of calories on the planet today. The problem right now is one of distribution. Now, in the future, we can talk about that. But right now, we're in a world where distribution is a very big problem.
Why has this become the dominant narrative, though? Because it's not just coming from Monsanto, these multinationals saying we need to double food production. I mean, it's coming from the UN.
Well, I mean, within the echo chamber of the World Food Prize, this is a prize that's funded by large agricultural producers. These aren't people who are in the business of distributing food. These are the people who are in the business of profiting from its production. Of course, they're going to say what we need is more food production rather than what we need is ways to empower poor people to be able to afford better food, and we need to raise wages so everyone can afford to eat well. You're not going to hear that from Monsanto or Syngenta, are you?
Well, so give us a visual of the landscape. What does it really look like when we talk about food production? How much of it is produced by these multinationals, and how much of it is produced by, small-scale and women food producers? Because according to ActionAid, that's one of the major solutions when we talk about what it will take to feed the population. Kristen, can you kind of paint us a picture of what food production actually looks like today?
Well, when you look, I mean, ActionAid works on the African continent. For example, ActionAid works in 40 countries around the world, including many countries in Africa. And if you look at the situation there, you see that the majority of food that people consume is produced by small-scale food producers. It's not being produced on large industrial-scale farms. And so if you want to address the problem of hunger and poverty on the African continent, the most logical place to types of projects to scale up are those that provide assistance and support to smallholder farmers, especially women farmers, who are over half of the smallholder farmers in Africa are women. And so looking at, and this is again where the economic models miss the mark to a great extent, because they don't look, the basic assumptions that they make are more oriented towards, make an assumption that investing in large-scale agriculture is the only way to increase production to the levels that will be needed, and don't learn from the experiences on the ground of people who are growing food locally to feed their families and to feed their local communities. But when you look from a local context at how you would fight poverty and how you would fight hunger in some of the hungriest and most impoverished areas on the planet, it is in investing and increasing providing support for smallholder farmers to produce more food to feed themselves, their families, their communities, and to create systems, local food systems, that would allow for the community to feed itself.
And again, Chris, I just wanted to jump in and sort of second that behind all of this is this idea that we need to feed the world, whoever this we is. Often it's been American foreign policy that we are going to feed the world. Uncle Sam comes with bags of whatever it is that Uncle Sam wants to give the people of the world. And small farmers have, from around the world, in peasant movements like the International Peasant Movement, La Via Campesina, which is, you know, over 200 small farmers and rural workers, landless people, have come up and said, actually, the world can feed itself and small farmers can actually feed the planet. And some of the data that we have is you know, points very much to what Kristen is saying, that 60% of the world's food, the food that's eaten around the world, is grown by small farmers. So industrial agriculture actually isn't feeding the world. It's feeding a minority of the planet. And what we're hearing is a bid for this industrial agriculture to spread further.
In 2008, the global food crisis made national headlines and international headlines, and then it disappeared as it was replaced by the financial crisis. Raj, what has really changed since 2008 as this issue got more attention?
Well, there's good and bad. I mean, let's start with the bad, shall we? I mean, there were a number of international summits that foregrounded this idea of the world food crisis, and there was a summit in Italy, and then there were various follow-up attempts. The Group of Eight countries last year came out with something called the New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition, in which the United States government and its G8 partners would chip in some money to help eradicate, or rather to lift 50 million people out of poverty by the year 2020. But mainly, the most of the money behind this initiative comes from large corporations who are part of this alliance. You hear a lot of this talk about alliance and partnership. And, just like Naomi Klein suggests, whenever there's a crisis, there's a kind of moment of a shock doctrine, and no crisis has been allowed to go to waste, not even the food crisis. And so you're seeing, as a result of the food crisis, a lot of new initiatives where international corporations are pushing their way into, particularly into Africa, but other parts of the world as well. So Yara, for example, the world's largest fertilizer company, is giving billions of dollars to this initiative, this new alliance for food security and nutrition. And you have a range of other initiatives, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, and other initiatives in which large multinationals are going to come in and entrench themselves in developing countries in order to feed the world. And of course, by doing that, they crowd out the very initiatives that are already bubbling up from grassroots initiatives in the global south, in developing countries, that are far more promising. But if that's the bad, then we've also seen a number of countries adopt a new idea, not food security, but food sovereignty. And it's an idea that was first debated in the 1990s. Again, it was an idea that came up from Via Campesina, this international peasant movement. And what they were saying is, look, it's all very good for us to have this idea of food security and everyone being able to have access to food. But we can't really meaningfully talk about access to food when you have these large corporations whistling in and out of our country as they please, buying up land as they want, and engaging in international trade with citizens locked out of the process. What we need is more democracy in our food system. And that's what the call for food sovereignty was. And actually, as a result of the 2007-2008 crisis, six countries have adopted food sovereignty as national agendas, three of them in their constitutions. Now, they're still trying to figure out what that means.
Which ones?
So we've got Mali, Venezuela, and Ecuador, I think, that have them as a constitutional thing, and then Nicaragua, Bolivia, and I'm forgetting the name of the other. But you have these countries that are sort of pushing for food sovereignty as a goal. So that what that means is that involves redistribution, it involves citizen control of the food system, and that seems to augur much better for a world where you can eradicate hunger.
That is Raj Patel, visiting scholar at UC Berkeley Center for African Studies and a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy. Raj is the author of Stuffed and Starved, and he's working on a documentary about global hunger issues. Kristen Sundell is a policy analyst with ActionAid USA, a nonprofit working with poor and marginalized communities to eradicate poverty. She's co-author of the new report, Rising to the Challenge, Changing Course to Feed the World in 2050. And today we're talking about solutions to the global hunger crisis. According to the UN, 1 billion people go hungry every day. About 3 billion are not eating well. Here in the United States, 47 million people are on food stamps. And they just found out that their benefits will be cut by $36 a month. That's a lot of money when you're trying to eat on $4 a day. The average family of four in the U.S. gets about $668 a month from the food stamp program. So today we're talking about solutions to feeding the world. We're hearing a lot about how food production must double or increase to even 70%. What are your thoughts on that? What questions do you have about food production? And then what do you think about reports by groups like ActionAid that say those are actually misguided policy prescriptions? And what we really need to look at are threats like climate change, lagging support for small-scale farmers, a lot of women, almost half women, and then the massive loss of food to waste. What other solutions would you like to come up with? And if you work with any food justice organizations, what do the conversations sound like when you talk about ending hunger? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And then what are your thoughts about groups that say individuals can also play a role in this, that the choices we make can also have an effect? 866-798-8255. You can also email us feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Kristen, Raj was talking about food sovereignty and some of the things that have changed since the 2008 food crisis. What else have you seen that's changed that is maybe hopeful?
Well, I think this, again, as Raj had, what Raj just presented, sort of a more negative strand and a positive, I think another place where we've seen a lot of change since 2008 is in the area of biofuels, both in the growth of mandates globally for biofuels use, but then also I think a growing, in the United States context certainly, and this is a hopeful, I think this is something that's hopeful, a growing pushback against the growth of crop-based biofuels. Biofuels expansion, again, is one of it's a phenomena that's been really poorly captured by a lot of the economic models that we're examining in our report that are calling for food production to be dramatically scaled up. You know, while making those calls for rising food production by, you know, between 60 and 100%, they're ignoring the fact that we are now on track to divert as much as 13% or more of our cereal production of corn and soybeans into the fuel tanks of our cars. And in ignoring, I mean, it's really puts these projections in question when you realize that that we're assuming, I mean, in the United States context, we use 40% of our corn crop currently goes to produce corn ethanol to go into our gas tanks. So you really have to question this productivist agenda again. If we were making different choices in terms of our energy use, it would have a huge impact on land availability to grow food, and as well as in make a big difference in food prices. And we're seeing it in the United States since the drought in 2012 and the spike in corn prices that resulted from the mandate, the inflexible mandate, keeping demand for the corn crop at a 50% or more that year because the corn crop was so decimated, went to make fuel instead of to feed people. And as a result, corn prices spiked around the world, which had a really potentially very devastating impact on people's access to food. And so there's a real movement, both in the European Union and in the United States, To push back against that and to eliminate mandates for crop-based biofuels.
So when you look at food production, one-third of what's being produced feeds animals, which are then fed to humans. 5% is used for biofuels, and about a third is wasted. So we'll talk about the animals and the waste in a few minutes. But to stick with the biofuels, why? Where is this happening? I mean, is it mostly in the U.S. or...?
No, it's happening all around the world now, and it's—I mean, the main producers are the United of biofuels are the United States and Brazil, but we're seeing more and more countries adopting biofuels mandates and also investing again. And it's part of this industrial-scale agricultural development model that's been pushed by the United States and also, in the case of biofuels, by Brazil, which has an ethanol diplomacy program, which is on the African continent especially, investing, incentivizing investment in biofuels production. And so this push is, when you look at... what the recent research has indicated, which is that biofuels have been responsible for up to 40% of recent spikes in food prices, this is a really dangerous trend.
Yeah, Raj, this is a huge number. It doesn't really get much attention.
Well, I mean, it did at the time of the global food price crisis, where people wanted to know where the, you know, why was this going, what the prices going up so high. But you're right. I mean, these days, the contribution of biofuels to global food prices has almost become normal, and that's a sign of the success of the biofuels industry and their lobby. And I think, you know, part of what we have to do if we're imagining a new economy is to point out how ridiculous it is that we're growing food not in order to eat, but to set on fire. There's something pretty disturbing about that. And I think that again, I mean, the 40% is at the high end of the estimates, but it's still, I think that there's a fairly large consensus that because of the effect of biofuels in international markets, right? Bear in mind that it's not, what small producers in Malawi are getting for their millet or their sorghum. This is about corn prices and global corn prices. But in those markets, there's a very big effect because the U.S. is such a large corn exporter. So when U.S. corn, for example, gets burned instead of eaten, that has a global ripple effect because the U.S. is the largest corn producer on Earth,
right.
Exporter on Earth, rather.
So, I mean, when you look at the biofuel debate in this country, there's sort of a healthy debate even within the environmental community.
Well, yes, though, I mean, I think that we're also moving to a stage of recognizing that while there may be moments where, you know, biofuels, when they're produced on a small scale and they're produced as part of a sustainable agroecological system, may have a role, in general, industrial uses of biofuels are unconscionable because they involve turning large scale cropland into, as I say, into fuel. But one of the pushbacks has been, well, you know, maybe we can find places in the global south, places in Africa or what have you, that are being underutilized, and use that land to grow fuel crops that then get turned into fuel. And unfortunately, that's driving what's called a global land grab. Now, we don't know that the precise numbers of this, there's a certain amount of mystery about it, but we do know that, according to the World Bank, an area the size of France was bought by foreign companies, often looking to be able to plant corn to be able to turn into fuel.
Today we're talking about the global hunger crisis and the best ways to feed the growing population. By 2050, we're expected to hit 9 billion people by then. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call, a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to engage in today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can post your comment or question at yourcallradio.org. Send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about the best ways to reduce California's prison population, which is now at 120,000 people. Under a federal court mandate, California is required to reduce its prison population by 10,000 inmates. So what is the best way to go about doing this? And then Thursday, we will continue coverage of the Affordable Care Act. A lot of people are losing their health insurance. If you're one of them, we'd love to hear from you on Thursday. A lot of people also are going on the Covered California site and are finding that the only alternatives are more expensive than their existing plan. So if you have any questions about the Affordable Care Act, be sure to tune in on Thursday. And then on Saturday, we will be hosting a special broadcast from the Green Festival in San Francisco from noon to 2. So be sure to tune in for that. And you can also stop by the booth and say hi. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the global food crisis. According to the UN, 1 billion people go hungry every day around the globe. About 3 billion people are not eating well. Here in the United States, 47 million people are on food stamps, and they just saw their benefits were cut by $36 a month. So what are the best ways to ensure that everyone is fed? What are your thoughts on this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts about calls to double food production around the globe? If you work with a food justice organization, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Raj Patel, visiting scholar at UC Berkeley Center for African Studies and a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy. Raj is author of Stuffed and Starved, and he's working on a documentary about global hunger. Kristen Sundell is a policy analyst with ActionAid USA. She's co-author of their new report, Rising to the Challenge, Changing Course to Feed the World in 2050. And let's hear from GS in Richmond. Hi, GS. Welcome to the show.
Hello, folks. Thank you very much. I certainly second everything that's been said recently about the whole biofuel track that we've gone down. Seemed like a good idea at the time, but oh well, and now we're realizing it could be done a different way. My personal concern, I mean, I think back to when I was a boy, and it seems to me the population was in excess already at, what was it, 3 billion or 4 or 5 billion, and now we're getting up to a really catastrophic realm, and we are, once again, Paul Ehrlich predicted this, we're looking at an exponential growth curve, and so my suggestion is, even if we start educating primarily women about the value of having fewer kids, about learning more about how to manage their own lives and so on, empower women the best I can think of ever have heard about, and we have a whole generation to take to educate before 2050 rolls around. Anyway, my point is we have got to put the brakes on human population growth because this is a finite planet and we're looking at infinite growth, and we're going to crash if we don't really pull back on the population. Thank you
so much, GS. We also have a web comment from Faye who says, what happened to zero population growth? Why can't we discuss planning families and countering religion's command to procreate? Kristen, what are your thoughts on this? Do any of these reports deal with population growth and family planning?
We mainly focused on the reports that take the 9 billion by global population of 9 billion by 2050 projection as a given, and then look at what would be necessary to feed the world by 2050, given that. I would say, though, in response to the points that have been made, I would say that one of the best ways to address population growth is by addressing poverty and is by investing in education. And one of the best ways to fight poverty and injustice is by supporting smallholder, most poor people in the global south are small-scale food producers. So by providing more support and more investment to small-scale food producers is one way to address this broader range of issues. I would also say it's, I think, very important to look at how we use our resources, especially in the global north. And obviously, it's the level of resource use that the lifestyle that supports the lifestyle that we have here is not sustainable.
And Raj, what are your thoughts on population growth?
I mean,
and is this something that hunger advocates talk about?
Well, I mean, there's a race dimension here that's important to flag, and I'm not saying anyone who talks about population is automatically a racist. However, what I am saying is that often when these discussions have come up in the past, it's always been, well, you know, those people over there, those brown people, they're shagging and they're having too many kids. I can say that on the radio, can't I?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're having too many kids, and they need, you know, they're part of the problem. When in fact, you know, the problem isn't having too many kids. It's about what people consume. I mean, if we're worried about the finitude of the planet, if this is a finite planet, then clearly we need to be an increasing number of people on that planet. We need to be worried about the people who are consuming the most. And of course, the people who are consuming the most are in North America and in Europe and in the global north. But no one thinks about population, you know, the population issue as well. We need to go around sterilizing Americans though logically, if we wanted to have the greatest impact for population growth and reducing the consumption of the world's resources, that would be the way to go.
Because our global footprint is so massive.
We don't have enough of a planet for us to be able to eat, for example, the amount of meat that we do in the United States.
Well, even compared to the United Kingdom.
Right. No, that's it. I mean, obviously, the way we consume in the United States is way beyond our fair share of the planet. But that's a much more awkward conversation to have than to say, well, you know, we should probably educate girls in the global south, which is obviously true. But the problem is, of course, we, through the policies that we've been pushing the World Bank and what have you, education's become harder for girls in the global south. I mean, mm-hmm. On the one time bemoan the lack of education of girls in the global south, but we charged for it in the 1990s. Of course, poor people have limited resources. We need to be thinking much more seriously about how it is that we in the global north encourage and empower women in the global south rather than disempowering them as we have to date.
Hmm. So is there hardly any discussion about this then within the food movement?
Well,
because of these concerns?
No, I mean, I think people in the food movement have a good sense that we need to be talking about women's empowerment, but we also need to be talking seriously, though it's a difficult question to have, about changing our footprint in the global north as well.
All right. Well, thank you for the comments and the call. Let's go next to Jonathan in Mountain View. Hi, Jonathan.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I find this conversation completely fascinating, and it's been so frustrating and disconcerting to listen to these types of statistics. Just as you were pointing out, the United States, which represents about 4.4% of the world's population, is using over 20% of the world's resources. I've addressed this problem, or at least I've been trying to address this problem. I work for NASA, and in my job, and looking at what's called life support or closed system life supports, these systems look at the most difficult environments in not just our world, but other worlds, and ask, how can you make a system function by basically optimizing the use of resources? And I've developed a system that I wanted to share with you and your listeners. It's called OMEGA. The acronym stands for Offshore Membrane Enclosures for Growing Algae. Now, the concept is the following. We grow algae, which grow very nicely. These are microscopic organisms. They grow very nicely on wastewater from our cities, our coastal cities. In our coastal cities, this wastewater is dumped offshore. So what the plan is to build these floating bioreactors, which are called photobioreactors because they're transparent, and they grow plants, in this case microscopic algae, on wastewater. So by growing microalgae on wastewater, we can produce biofuels. Algae, microalgae in particular, are the best source of biofuels on the planet. 90% of the oil that we now harvest comes from algae that lived millions of years ago. So now we have a source of not only producing a biofuel that doesn't compete with agriculture for water or for fertilizer, it also doesn't compete for land. So this system called OMEGA, which is now structurally offshore in protected coastal areas like San Francisco Bay is a good example, although we probably would never put it there, but there's bays all over the world. This protected system then becomes a platform for solar panels and for aquaculture. In addition, the algae clean the wastewater. So the wastewater that's released into the ocean is now no longer polluted with nutrients that cause algae blooms that lead to dead zones, that lead to the degradation of our coastal waters. But the water itself can also be recovered. So this Omega system I wanted to present to you because it's a system that we've been working on now for 5 years, and we've been trying to sort of get going in the rest of the world so that people start looking at solutions that, in this case, is looking at a source of renewable and sustainable fuel.
Well, Jonathan, I just checked out the NASA site and found information about the algae-based biofuel. So thank you for calling in, and we'll put a link on our website after if others are interested in this. Raj, are you familiar with this?
I'm not familiar with this particular project, though I know that there are moves to be able to find more sustainable ways than, as we were saying earlier on, growing fuel from food on land that people would be growing food on. But it does still wed us to this model of a carbon-based energy economy. And I think that if we're being imaginative about how things work in the future, moving away from a carbon-based economy is important. I mean, what's also part of our conversation here that's always in the background is climate change. Mm-hmm. Climate change is oddly given as an alibi for why it is that we need to grow more food rather than thinking about distributing it better. If we're continuing to pump more carbon into the atmosphere, and I appreciate that one of the merits of the system is that it involves not drilling more but actually cycling carbon better. But nonetheless, if we're still wedded to a carbon economy, we're still part of an economy that is feeding into climate change and is making agriculture much more precarious.
Well, thank you again for calling, Jonathan. And Kristen, what about climate change? Because, again, your report that calls food production, or that calls other reports calls to increase food production misguided, you say that we really need to deal with inadequate investment in climate-resilient agriculture.
Yes, absolutely. And we're really only barely beginning to understand the implications of climate change for agriculture and food security. And the models that go to 2050 don't even tell the whole story, because the impacts post-2050 are expected to be much, much worse than what we're going to be seeing up to that point. Another point I think that's been inadequately considered by current economic forecasting and current models of what will be needed to produce enough food by 2050 is in these calls for scaling up industrial agricultural production, there's very little consideration given to what will be the impacts on the climate of continuing to invest and to promote a model of agriculture that requires an enormous amount of fossil fuels in the form of fertilizers, especially. And so those are issues that it's very difficult for us to model accurately the impacts of climate change. But what we do know is that we are seeing the impacts now, that adequate finance for adaptation, including agricultural techniques that have a low impact on the climate as well as help communities to adapt to the impacts that we're already seeing are urgently needed.
And Raj, what really stands out for you when you look at how climate change is affecting the food supply?
Well, I mean, it's the variability. I mean, I'm working on the documentary, as you've mentioned, and we're following communities around the world. We visited Peru, where we saw the growing season has shrunk by 50%.
50%?
Over the past 20 years. And in Malawi, there's been incredibly variable weather. And so people just don't know what's going to come next. And certainly what this suggests to me is that when we're thinking about a future agriculture, we need not only to be thinking about more food, but we need to be thinking about ideas that are actually very, very old. Things like grain stores, for example. I mean, if you go to the Andes, you see the sort of remnants of Inca grain stores that were able to feed 7 million people. Our grain stores in this country have been largely privatized, and that's something I think we need to be reversing. If we want to ride out climate change, we need buffers, and all those buffers have been privatized over the past 30 years. So we do need ways in which we can withstand these shocks a lot better than our policymakers have prepared us for.
How has privatization affected the food supply?
One of the economic arguments against having a grain reserve is that you don't want the government to be sitting on all this grain. It's just lying there. Surely what you need is a network of international trade, and you can sell off the grain stores, and you can rely on the international market to provide. If there's a shortage in one place, then go to the market and buy from somewhere else, and that'll help, you know, that'll help restore lower prices. You're wasting money if you're just buying grain and sitting on it. The trouble is that once you have this international connected market, a systemic shock in one or two big production areas can then be spread through these very transmission mechanisms that were meant to sort of save you. They can spread and become a global problem. So this logical idea of preventing, wasting money by having, by not having grain stores, ends up being a way in which you reduce the insulation that people have to these big climate shocks.
What else is being privatized in the food system?
Well, even we think of something like food stamps, for example. They are vitally important to be able to help people survive the dignified emergency in the United States or elsewhere. But if you look at who benefits, it's everyone from Walmart to J.P. Morgan. You have these large corporations at the trough at the very same time as we're trying to help poor people in the United States. There's not an area of the food system at the moment that hasn't been scavenged by the world's largest corporations.
Well, when you talk about the world's largest corporations, we did a show, it's been about a year now, maybe, on speculation. And what is the status right now on speculation affecting food prices? According to The Guardian, they've got a piece called What Goldman Sachs Should Admit, It Drives Up the Cost of Food. According to this piece, in 2012, Goldman Sachs made $400 million from speculating on food, and the World Bank estimated that in 2010, 44 million people were pushed into poverty because of high food prices, and speculation is one of the main causes.
There's an amount of debate around this, but to my mind, it seems as if there's plenty of evidence to suggest that people are making money off speculating and driving up the price of food. In the European Union right now, there is a debate around how speculators could and should be limited. And there was a leaked document that was exposed just last night in which the British government lobbied hard to have loopholes left open so that speculators could still manage to get away with this kind of speculation. So there's still a healthy debate around around speculation, but it seems like the speculators are trying to buy their way out of it, as they always do.
That is Raj Patel. He is a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy. Raj is author of Stuffed and Starved, and he's working on a documentary about global hunger. We are also joined by Kristen Sundell, policy analyst at ActionAid USA, a nonprofit working with poor and marginalized communities to eradicate poverty. She's the author of the new report, Rising to the Challenge, Changing Course to Feed the World in 2050. And we're talking today about solutions to ensure that everyone is fed. If you work with a food justice organization, what are your thoughts on this issue? What changes have you seen over the year? What are your solutions? And what are your thoughts on calls to double food production? What questions do you have about that? And then what are your thoughts on the best way to go about this? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We have a question from a listener who says, why are people going hungry here in the United States, or why they don't have enough food to eat? And there's a great documentary called A Place at the Table that really looks at this. And you're in it, Raj.
Yes. The key reason, and Kristen knows this well from ActionAid's work in Africa, the key reason that people go hungry is not because there is a shortage of food. It's about poverty. And poverty doesn't, it has some very specific contours. For example, people don't know that the 60% of those going hungry in the world today are women or girls. Poverty is, and hunger is a gender issue. And that's that's as true in the United States as anywhere else. If you look at the group most likely to be food insecure in the United States, it's female-headed households. Mm. Now, that's not something that gets spoken of when you have your Monsantos and your Syngenta saying what we need to do is grow more food, because to observe the gender disparities in hunger and poverty is actually to observe something very systemic about the way capitalism works, rather than to be able to say something that can be fixed with more grain or more soy or more corn.
Well, and food stamp cuts. The food stamps were cut by $5 billion for this fiscal year. 47 million Americans, one in five Americans. Were you surprised, Raj, at this recent cut? I mean, $35, $38 a month is a lot.
I was shocked, frankly. I mean, it's going to show up in the hunger figures. I mean, it's if you look at the numbers of Americans who are food insecure before the before the 2007 crisis, the number was hovering around 35 million, which was still pretty high. And now we're, as you say, we're at 47, 48 million who are food insecure. This is, by cutting food stamps, you're guaranteeing that number goes up. And it seems to me a deeply cynical move by lawmakers in order to be able to check their scorecards in terms of fiscal probity is by cutting food from the poor so that the rich can carry on getting subsidized.
Kristen, why don't we've got about 7 or 8 minutes left here. Why don't we talk about some of the other solutions you point to in your report? Let's talk about food waste and spoilage. You found that one third of global food production fails to nourish anyone.
That's right. And this is both a developing country issue as well as an issue in the developed world. And needs to be urgently addressed both places. But, in industrialized countries, our wasteful consumption patterns could be need to be better addressed, and then in developing countries, we really need to invest in storage and in mechanisms for getting food to market, so that there isn't as much food lost, and that investing there, none of the current models is actually pretty striking that none of the current modeling, none of the solutions that are being put forward, virtually none address these issues, although it has been a focus of the United Nations recently and of the FAO. So this is a place where, it's sort of seems disingenuous to be calling for huge increases in food production while letting the issue of food waste and spoilage go unaddressed.
And it seems like food waste is actually getting a lot more attention these days, Raj.
It is, and that's pleasing because, I grew up with that maxim of, eat up, there are children starving in Africa. And it always puzzled me as to why my finishing my greens would affect children in Africa in any way. It is interesting that there are two different kinds of food waste issue. Here in the United States, we're so used to having fish and shrimp and beef and chicken and whatever it is on the menu that restaurants will stock all of this stuff, even if people don't eat it. And then a lot of it goes to waste on the consumer end. Whereas the food waste issue in developing countries is about storage and about post-harvest loss. And I'm very pleased that that's much more on the agenda, because if we're interested in poor people, particularly in the global South, being able to eat, that's a really key issue.
And since you brought up animals, again, it's kind of shocking to read that one third of what is being produced actually feeds animals, and then those animals are fed to humans.
Yeah, and I think we had the head of the Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, talking about how, well, if we're interested in a more climate change appropriate agriculture and diet, we do need to get used to eating more fresh fruits and vegetables and fewer animals. And I think that that's a smart way to go, particularly when one looks at the kinds of things that attend animal agriculture in the U.S. and around the world. We probably do want to shift away from eating quite as much meat as we do in the U.S.
People in the U.N. are saying this.
Absolutely.
Also. What about individual choices? As you just said, you were told to eat everything off your plate because people are starving. How do our choices affect what happens around the globe? I mean, I'm thinking about my local corner store. I've noticed in the last 2 years that I can now buy just about every fruit you can name year-round, and that's new. And I said, why can I get grapes this month? I couldn't get grapes 2 years ago in this month. And they said, because people are demanding it.
Well, I mean, I think that when you think about individual choices, we often immediately go to shopping because that's the individual choice that most of us are conditioned to be making most often. And I certainly think, buying smart is a good idea because buying dumb is generally not a good idea, right? So shopping with the seasons and making sure that you're buying locally and that you're asking around the wages of the workers who are working and feeding you, that's a good idea. But it's also a personal choice to get involved in politics and personal choice to get involved in community organisations. So here in the Bay Area, we've got Food First and Anna LaPay's Small Planet Institute and the People's Community Market and People's Grocery. You have so many fantastic organisations that we can make our personal choice to be involved with and to support. I mean, I think that that's part of what it is to have a personal choice, is to personally choose not to have your political power taken away from you.
What would you add to that, Kristen?
I would add that there are some really important opportunities for just that type of political engagement right now. There are bills in both the House and in the Senate that would end the corn ethanol mandate. I think Senator Barbara Boxer is the chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee that should be considering this policy change, and she actually is currently opposes it. So letting her hear that the impact of biofuels on food price volatility and food security must be addressed, and that the U.S. corn ethanol mandate is a big part of the problem. She needs to hear that from her constituents. Foreign aid policies have a huge impact around the world, and we need to be more responsible about the agricultural model that we are promoting in this country. I mean, the U.S. has been championing the New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition that Raj talked about earlier, which is really pushing large-scale agriculture, is pushing land grabs, is in order to join the New Alliance, developing countries have to basically facilitate access to large tracts of land by industrial agriculture. They have to open up their markets to genetically modified seeds. So rather than investing in this type of model, we should be providing support for small-scale agriculture and for agriculture that's climate resilient.
Kristen Sundell is a policy analyst with ActionAid USA. Raj Patel is a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy and the author of Stuffed and Starved. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. It's Your Call. What are the best ways to reduce California's prison population, which is now 120,000? Under a federal court mandate, California is required to reduce its population by nearly 10,000 inmates. Governor Jerry Brown wants to spend $315 million over the next year to house inmates in private and county jails. Critics prefer alternatives like paroling elder prisoners. So how should the state deal with overcrowding in prisons? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.